is Millie Long, and I'm the co-editor-in-chief of American Journal of Gastroenterology, and welcome to our podcast. I'm excited that my guest today is actually my co-editor-in-chief of American Journal of Gastroenterology, Dr. Jaz Bajaj, who's currently professor of medicine at Virginia Commonwealth University. And thrilled to have you here, Jaz, to talk about your new acute on chronic liver failure guideline.
Thank you. And thank you to the ACG for actually making this happen. This is the novel, one of the novel guidelines on this in the world, in the GI societies, and happy to share this with all our listeners.
I think it's just going to be become so important for our listeners from a clinical standpoint to help to incorporate this guidance into their clinical practice. And so I kind of want to set the stage by asking you, these guidelines are on acute on chronic liver failure. So could you tell me a little bit about the difference between hepatic decompensation and acute on chronic liver failure? How do you really define acute on chronic liver failure?
This is a very important question and something that has plagued this field for a very long time, because for us to have a definition for a disease that is separate from another disease, you actually have to have a biomarker that clearly says, yes, this is the person who has this, but not that. And this disease or whatever disease has to behave very differently from the other disease so that clinicians can already make their plans ahead that this person is in decompensation only, whereas this person has reached the stage of ACLF or acute on chronic liver failure. Sometimes they become shades of gray, but critically, the important thing is ACLF is really defined as a potentially reversible condition in patients with chronic liver disease. And the important thing is you do not need to have cirrhosis. You can have F3 or F2 or higher grades of fibrosis with or without cirrhosis for people to have this potential for multiple organ failure. So the critical point here is organ failure, which is not necessarily the case in someone who may have stable encephalopathy or even multiple episodes of encephalopathy without requiring, dialysis or things like that. So it is, in a sense, a continuum, but because it is such a huge survival difference, this makes it a separate entity which needs to be looked for, and the clinicians need to be aware of when the person slips from acute decompensation into ACLF, because their survival chances take a major hit, and they could potentially be considered for liver transplant and other measures.
So this is critically important. And so for our clinicians out there, is there a way to assess, once you meet that criteria for acute on chronic liver failure, is there a way to assess severity within their clinical practice so that they know how to act?
There are many ways of doing this. And as you know, this liver disease is not the same around the world. In parts of Asia, they're usually people who are not only in the background of cirrhosis, but also in chronic liver disease that we just talked about. You could have hepatitis B reactivation that can cause acute and chronic liver failure in these patients. So the definitions in different parts of the world are unfortunately a little different, but almost all of them converge on the concept of organ failures that we talk about. Some of the definitions of organ failures are a little different from each other, which is kind of, we are working towards building a consensus around it. But the way to diagnose it right now is, unfortunately, when things have passed to an extent where we most likely do our best to reverse it, but often we can't. So definitions of organ failures differ, but the concept remains the same, that the more organ failures you have, the worse off you're going to be, in addition to the underlying liver disease and cirrhosis. Some definitions, such as the North American Consortium, is very simple, and they tend towards diagnosing people who are very futile. Whereas there's other definitions, such as the CLIF Consortium in Europe, which is a lot more subtle, but again, may get people who are complicated to diagnose, but that actually also gets people who may be a little too advanced. The Asia Pacific one actually can pick up people who are earlier on in their disease, but then these patients often have a chance of getting better without the diagnosis of ACLF. So we are still searching for a happy medium that actually defines what is acute on chronic liver failure and the severity. But clearly, as we know, and as common sense demands, the more organ failures a person actually has, the worse off they're going to be from a prognostic standpoint, regardless of what their underlying etiology of ACLF was.
No, that makes total sense. And it makes sense for us to recognize and act earlier, potentially, while keeping in mind that, obviously, as you pointed out, that some of these people may actually get better on their own. So that timing is important for transplant evaluations, obviously, and other factors. But I think that what I really liked about your guideline, I do want to delve into the guideline now, is that you really organized it by some of these organ failure systems and that kind of helped to provide graded recommendations by each of these components. And so there are a number of factors, a number of categories: brain failure, respiratory failure, coagulation failure, infections, and looking at transplant as compared to futility. So I'd love to review kind of an important recommendation from each of those categories that you'd like to emphasize from the guideline. So let's start with brain failure. What recommendation would you like to emphasize for our listeners?
Yeah, the important thing is brain failure is the only organ failure that everyone has the same definition. Grade 3 or 4 West Haven criteria is considered brain failure. And where it becomes a problem is when someone is intubated. And when someone is intubated with brain conditions or respiratory failure, despite optimal therapy, means you've treated them, take care of the pneumonia or whatever the patient has, and make sure that their encephalopathy is reversed and the patients are still not waking up. An important graded suggestion was we suggest against listing for liver transplantation to improve mortality in these patients. And this is very, very important because we have no idea whether these patients are going to wake up after that as well and what their quality of life is going to be. So this is an important graded recommendation for brain failure. There are a couple of others, but please feel free to look at the guidelines for this.
Great. Well, let's move on to respiratory failure, obviously also a dreaded complication, but what would you emphasize for our listeners in that category?
And building on to this very important thing, respiratory failure was also part of the prior statement that I just talked about the intubation. But infections, which we are going to talk about at length later, which are one of the most common precipitants, are often complicated by multi-drug resistance or unnecessary use of antibiotics. So we thought it was important that in patients with cirrhosis who are ventilated, we suggest against prophylactic antibiotics to reduce mortality or duration of mechanical ventilation, because the evidence that these antibiotics would improve any of these outcomes is not very clear. And there is ample evidence that unnecessary use of antibiotics will engender multi-drug resistance as well as fungal infections in these patients at the time where they can least afford it.
So hugely important. So clinicians out there should not be prophylacting with antibiotics when these patients go on the vent. It's a great recommendation. What about coagulation failure? We see this frequently, unfortunately. Yeah.
Coagulation failure in this guideline has quite a few statements that have been graded, which is unlike a lot of other failures. And that is important because this is such a topic that people misuse some of these things. And what I think is the most important out of all of these, there are plenty, in patients with cirrhosis and acute and chronic liver failure, we suggest against INR as a means to assess coagulation risk. That is very important because often when we send these patients for things with interventional radiology, they require the INR to be fixed. They required all of these things to be fixed. What we want to delve in is the coagulation is more than just INR. It has so many moving parts and all of them have to be assessed. And if you look at some of the other guideline statements, TEG or ROTEM has a lot more specificity to accurately assess transfusion needs and coagulation factors in these patients than simple INR. So this is an important concept for our readers and practitioners, and that spans not just hepatology, but also in interventional radiology, other specialties that do interventions on these patients, as well as the intensive care unit physicians and the ER physicians, that not to rely solely on INR as the be-all and end-all of coagulation risk.
That's great because I think that's pervasive. I know that happens a lot at our center. Well, correct the INR and then I'll do X. And, you know, I think this is a really important statement. And now we have guideline evidence that hopefully our listeners can bring to their hospitals and administrators and say, this is why we shouldn't be using just INR to measure. So that's hugely important. So the next organ failure we'll move on to is kidney failure. So tell me a little bit about a recommendation in this acute on chronic liver failure population in regards to kidney failure.
Now, kidney failure is the one that is the most variable when you look at the three definitions of acute on chronic liver failure. And that is why it's very important for us to separate the definitions of acute on chronic liver failure from what is known as HRS-AKI or hepatorenal syndrome acute kidney injury, which is the new terminology for hepatorenal syndrome. And therefore, a lot of these recommendations follow from the very exciting data that have been recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine, in which in patients with cirrhosis in stages 2 and 3 AKI, and you can read this, these are more advanced forms of acute on kidney injury, we suggest intravenous albumin and vasoconstrictors as compared to albumin alone to improve the creatinine in these patients. There are several other statements here that put a more nuanced role of albumin. Rather than giving it to everyone, I think the important thing that we have focused on here is give it to people who have true evidence that they need it, such as patients with spontaneous bacterial peritonitis, who can then lead on to acute on kidney injury and HRS-AKI, rather than giving it to every single patient who comes into the hospital, because high quality studies have shown that that indiscriminate use may actually not only not improve outcomes, but worsen outcomes. So a hugely important proximate cause of mortality is acute kidney injury in these patients.
No, that's a huge implication. And certainly it has implications for cost of care too, to help to get the albumin and vasoconstrictors, obviously, to the right populations. So let me move on. A couple more categories that I want to pick your brain on. The next would be infections, which are a huge risk factor for mortality in this population. So tell us a statement that may help our readers and our listeners in terms of managing and potentially even prophylaxing against infection.
Yeah, infections are such a major elephant in the room when it comes to patients with acute and chronic liver failure, because in most Western countries, and including some Eastern countries, they are usually the precipitant of everything going haywire. And many of these things might be relatively subtle, which means the presence of an acute kidney injury, which means 0.3 milligrams increase of creatinine only over the last 48 hours, or patients who just come in with hepatic encephalopathy or mild confusion, but nothing else. So what we want to do is prevent this from snowballing into not only liver failure, but actually multi-organ failure that constitutes ACLF. So this has been divided into several categories, which is just infections in general, nosocomial and fungal infections, and medications and prophylaxis for infection, because this is such a critical point. So what we have actually put here, that in hospitalized patients with decompensation, now these are not patients who have developed ACLF yet, and therefore this is a big difference between them. We recommend assessment for infection because infection is associated for development of ACLF and increased mortality, going on to what I suggested, because the signs of infection may be relatively subtle. And the other factors in this, including nosocomial and fungal infections, as we had talked about, unnecessary use of antibiotics in patients who had gotten a ventilation. We want to make sure in patients who've been admitted because of bacterial infections, who have not responded to the antibiotic therapy that we have prescribed them, we suggest suspicion of a multi-drug resistant organism or a fungal infection to improve the detection of this and therefore the treatment. So these are patients, as we all know in our practice, we start them with the broadest spectrum antibiotic, and if they're still not working, we want to make sure we follow the cultures. It's amazing how many times we actually don't follow the cultures for someone whose cultures were drawn 3 days ago, and we keep it either on a broader spectrum that they need to, or keep it on an antibiotic that they're just not sensitive to. And if between 2 to 3 days, and especially in people with jaundice, if things do not get better, or if they have renal insufficiency, we must consider in concert with our ID colleagues to see if we can expand the coverage to fungal infections. And this is where this comes from.
That's great to think about it, and think about it early. You're not thinking about it 2 weeks later. You're thinking about it 3 days in when you're looking at those cultures. I think that's really important for clinical care.
Yes. And I think when we talk about medications and prophylaxis, there are things that we can do in our practice right now. And these are all, as you know, prevention of ACLF rather than playing catch up, which the other failures that we would just talk about, they've already developed failure. Prevention and adequate treatment of infection will be the most effective tool in our armamentarium to prevent ACLF, because once that horse has left the barn, it's very difficult to actually make things right. What we do want to emphasize is we suggest avoiding proton pump inhibitors unless there's a clear indication in these patients. And we also want to make sure that we finesse the role of secondary versus primary SPP prophylaxis in these patients, because patients who've had one episode of spontaneous bacterial peritonitis are likely to have another one and with much worse complications and consequences. So we want to suggest the use of secondary prophylaxis in those patients as well for prophylaxis of infection. And there are plenty of other concept statements in that thing which deal not only with this, but also with things like immunizations and things that we can do as an outpatient or when the patient is immediately admitted to ensure that infections do not play a big part or at least are not allowed to run rife.
No, it's a great point. And I'd encourage our listeners to obviously check out the document and get into more details surrounding those aspects, which are, we're big believers in prevention. If we can prevent these downstream complications, we want to. So the last section I wanted to ask you about was a section on transplant versus futility and graded recommendations therein that might be important for our listeners.
So this is an important part because unfortunately, we want to be realists when it comes to managing our patients who are so critically ill, as the definition of ACLF already has an implied mortality subtext to it. We had already briefly discussed about this in the brain failure aspect about whether these patients are transplant candidates or not, if they were ventilated. But the important thing our field and most fields are moving towards is we suggest early goals of care discussion and, if appropriate, referral to palliative care to improve resource utilization in patients who are ACLF, who are not transplant candidates or who are not responding to therapies.
So hugely important, this intersection with palliative care and the fact that it obviously can really improve outcomes for our patients. I'm hoping in this digital age that even in places where you might not have access to palliative care, that, you know, remote consultation and other aspects may be able to occur to really bring them into the team structure, a huge part of management of a chronic disease.
And it's actually, it's relatively, I wouldn't say easy, but it's now accessible for specialists, interventionalists and everyone else to get adequate training in palliative care so they themselves can offer this to the families, because especially if the patient is ventilated, you know, the patient unfortunately does not become, you want to make sure that the families are involved first and this discussion is started early. And it becomes exceedingly challenging when someone was on the transplant list and now suddenly the factors have made themselves evident that they are not on the transplant list. So the sooner we start this discussion, the less of a shock it becomes for everyone, and the more likely we are going to be able to prognosticate the patient and bring closure to everyone.
Yeah, a huge part of this. Well, let me ask you, you know, obviously I've been a part of the guideline process before. It's a very time-consuming process. Can you share with the listeners, was there a part of the experience that you enjoyed the most?
I think it's bringing all these disparate people's points of view together in a one document, which is such a joy to bring together and make sure that it is a clinically useful document, which is also forward-looking. So there is many parts of this document that can be used to design future studies, but there are many parts that can be used to treat patients right now. So the fact that many people from different backgrounds across North America came together, were graded, reviewed, and ultimately produce this document that goes right from the pathogenesis to future directions to the management of current patients, while being sensitive to everyone's points of view from this diverse authorship as well as global studies. I think this is, to me, I thought was our biggest achievement, bringing it all together.
No, it's a wonderful document. I would definitely encourage our listeners to head to the pages of Red Journal to check it out. The guideline process for the ACG, that is, you mentioned the key part. We want these to be clinically relevant, and that's what's so important for the pages of Red Journal as well. And I think you will find this guideline to be so. So just as we're concluding, Jazz, I always like to end with something a little off the beaten path. Can you tell our listeners something interesting about yourself that they may not know?
Being from India, I do love Bollywood. I do like singing.
Oh, that's great.
I like Bollywood music and I like to sing. That's that great. Did not play any role in my selection, either as an EIC or in the guidelines. But this is something I think I would like to share with people.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you so much to my guest, Jazz Bajaj, also co-editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Gastroenterology. Please do turn to the pages of Red Journal. Thanks.
Thank you.